This is the Forces Station. This is BFBS.
BFBS, original Forces programs. Tall Stories. Jason Webster meets Stephen Merchant.
Stephen Merchant has had an incredible career so far, from starting in student radio to helping to create one of the biggest British comedies of all time. I caught up with Stephen in a pottery studio, of all places, in London to delve into the life of a man who's gone from the Bristol stand-up comedy scene to living the LA dream in the Hollywood Hills.
Ever see a blind man cross the road, trying to make the other side? Ever see a young girl growing old, trying to make herself a bride? So what becomes of you, my love, when love finally strips you?
Jason Webster meets Stephen Merchant.
How are you anyway?
Thanks for asking. Do you want the real answer?
Yeah, go on.
Because I've got a bit of jet lag. I'm an international jet setter. And if I'm not on, you know, if I'm not on a plane, then I'm in one of my, 14 houses. I wish. I have this fantasy that in my mind, Elton John has a house in every city. Mm. I don't know if that's true. I just imagine he does. That's my aspiration.
Every city that you go to, yeah. You just rock up and like, I'll have that one.
I was on a coach in somewhere like Greece or somewhere, and the guy went in his broken English, up there on hill. What accent is that?
I don't know.
Up there on hill, house of Elton John, only accessible by helicopter.
Wow.
I mean, you've made it when only reach your house by a helicopter.
So what was there, moats around it or something?
I think it was just on a hill, and there seemed to be no roads to the house. I don't know how they built the house.
Maybe they just shipped everything in.
Then they blew up the street that took you to the house. But yeah. I always remember thinking, if that's like Batman.
Waterfall kind of opens up.
That would be amazing, wouldn't it?
That's what you want.
Yeah.
You are living in LA and in the UK now. Like,
right.
How do you split your time?
It depends on what my mood is. And also, my aim is to try and be in America when it's cold in England. That's the same. That's the basic.
So at the moment, you're spending a lot of time in.
Yeah, foolishly, I'm here in England while it's cold. I'm also allergic to my flat in London. I don't know. I just, as soon as I get in there, within 24 hours, I appear to have the symptoms of a streaming cold. And people say, well, move. But I don't know if I could move into, another house and have the same problem.
I've just moved into my place.
Yeah.
There was a mouse on the TV last night.
There was a mouse on the TV?
A mouse, an actual living mouse. I've got a cat and a dog. They did nothing.
Did nothing. Hopeless. I'm not sure that you should move because you've got a mouse. That seems a little bit excessive.
Well, somebody said, if you've got a mouse, you got mice.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's kind of freaking
out. Who said
out.
That? That sounds like sort of like an elderly person from a film. Yeah. If you have a mouse, you have mice. Ah, wise.
Did you buy Ellen DeGeneres' house?
I did not buy Ellen DeGeneres' house.
Where has this come from then?
I don't know. I think Ellen used to own it some years ago, long before I ever got involved, yes. But of course, that doesn't make for a story, so just conflate it that so I bought it from Ellen.
What made you want to buy this house then? Was it just a massive, nice, it was a proper LA dream?
A little bit. I was spending a lot more time there just for work, and there is something appealing about the sort of Californian lifestyle. Mm. It is more outdoorsy. Mm. The truth is, it does feel like you're living the dream. I mean, there's no getting around it. It's in the hills, because I've bought into every cliche of an Englishman in Los Angeles. For a long time, I had a convertible, but I could barely fit in the car because I'm too big. I'm 6'7". I can't fit in most cars, certainly not a convertible. I really could only fit in there when the roof was down.
Yeah.
And, I had to get rid of that eventually, but I was trying desperately to live the fantasy.
It wasn't a convertible Mini, was it? Because I had the same problem. My wife was like, I want to get a Mini convertible. Got it. Can't get in it.
You're making bad move after bad move. You've got the mousy house, as we're calling it now.
Yeah.
You've got the Mini car. I mean, I don't want to. How long have you been married?
3.5 years.
You've still got time to get rid of her. Get rid of her and the house and the Mini at the same time. Yeah. Just a clean sweep.
Like I said, living the dream. Expensive cars.
Yes. Yeah. That I can't fit in.
Yeah, you can't fit in.
Yeah.
You've got a pool.
Yes.
Bowling alley in the house?
No, I mean, it's not that big. It's not that big. It's not bowling alley size. It's not home cinema size, but it's nice. It's pleasant. You'd like it.
Yeah.
Come and stay when you move out from your wife.
Well,
I've got a spare room.
I do fancy going to LA again.
There you are. You've been before?
Yeah, I proposed to my wife in Malibu.
That's classy, isn't it? Well, how did you do it? Take me through it. Because, one day I might have to do the same thing. Propose to your wife, I mean.
Yeah. You must have thought about this, about how you would propose.
I don't think I have, really. My friend, who's an artist, once told me how he proposed. I won't go into it because it goes on forever, but it was one of the most elegant and romantic ways, involving sort of almost puzzles that his fiancé had to solve. From the sound of it, it sounded a bit like a sort of low-level version of Lord of the Rings. There was like a quest, and then there was rings.
Yeah, of course.
And that always impressed me, that she had to jump through some hoops before she could get the proposal.
And then I suppose then he knows that she's serious about it.
Right, because she could have bailed on that.
Yeah, she could say, I'm not doing that. And he goes, well, you don't get the ring then.
Exactly.
You don't get the prize at the end, which is him.
Tall Stories. Jason Webster meets Stephen Merchant.
BFBS.
Takes off.
Stephen Merchant.
Do you work out LA style? Really into their fitness?
Yes, I do.
You do?
Yes,
so,
I do.
So
yes.
What's your workout routine now?
It's kind of much like other people's. Mm-hmm. You know, some running, jumping, skipping, hopping, weights. And I have a man mm-hmm. that shouts at me.
Yeah.
I have no commitment to exercise without the man. I cannot do it. The idea of getting up and going to a gym on my own, of my own volition, preposterous. Why would you waste your time doing that? So I need to pay someone in order to, because obviously I don't like wasting money. So if I've paid a gentleman and then we've put a slot in the day, then I will show up. If it was left to me, never get there.
Never
get there.
Is this guy like X-Forces?
He's not X-Forces.
They can be brutal.
I have worked out with X-Forces, gentlemen, and they are tough. They don't take any prisoners. But he knows how to kind of push me and mm-hmm. how to get the best out of me. And I do have to say, now exercise is part of my life, and I'm quite surprised. I never thought I'd do that. I only really took up doing exercise because I think I turned 35. And I just thought, I might die. So I should exercise. And that's really the reason I do it.
Yeah, I had a similar experience this Monday. Went for a run. Hadn't done that in 4 years.
Yeah.
I thought I was dying.
Of course you did.
I did 3K.
Yeah. Blimey, that's impressive.
Well, for a first time.
Not bad, is it? Yeah.
The thing is, I've told people.
You were running from a mouse.
Do you know what? I told people I did 3K on Monday. They were like, mm-hmm. is that it? I thought that was brilliant.
I think that sounds very impressive.
I mean,
so,
I could
yeah.
see to the end of where I wanted to run. So
yes.
It's not that impressive.
No, but it's important. And also in Los Angeles, you know, there is a vanity and a kind of an obsession with the aesthetic that you have to buy into. I mean, yeah. you just do. You're forced to.
Yeah.
Because everyone's doing it. You know, even the fattest, ugliest people have a trainer. It's absurd.
Tall Stories. Jason Webster meets Stephen Merchant.
BS. Now, you started off in radio, mm-hmm. didn't you? You were doing student radio. What student radio station was that then?
It was the University of Warwick radio station.
What type of show did you do when you went there? Was it something totally off the wall, you know, let's throw in jokes and stuff like that?
It was, I think I was probably very influenced by Chris Morris and, you know, that sort of being a bit provocative and a bit edgy, mm-hmm. you know, and sort of doing... Yeah, we did some sort of sketches, which I remember looking back were a bit tasteless. You know, it was all a bit ugly. So I think we thought that, yeah, we were being kind of provocative, but we were just being sick.
Because obviously times move on. At that time, you might have thought, this is great. This will
stand
the test of time.
Oh, at the time, yes. I think it was because also you, when you're like 20 or whatever we were, 19, you sort of think that you've got it all figured out and that you know who you are and that you've got mm-hmm. your own personality and your own style, but you haven't. You're still figuring it out, you know? And so I think it's not till later that you sort of figure out what your agenda is and your style, you know? And I think it took me a while to, oh, actually, no, I don't really like this. This is not really who I am.
Because you've done a bit of radio, then went on to do a bit of comedy as well, a bit of stand-up. What point in your life do you realise, I'm a funny guy, I should start writing stuff?
I don't know. Do you know, I've only really felt like I was a professional, that this was what I do in the last 5 years. That was when I thought, oh yeah, this is what I do now. The rest of the time was always that I always felt a bit like I was a sort of keen amateur. Mm. Like when I remember doing stand-up for the first time in Bristol, did 5 minutes at an open mic comedy night, killed it. Audience loved it. I thought, well, this is easy. Went back a couple of months later, terrible, died on my arse.
Is that the Eddie Izzard thing?
I was just doing, I suppose, again, like I was saying about the radio, there I was probably doing sort of bad sub-Eddie Izzard kind of stand-up. Again, he was like an influence at the time. And for ages with stand-up, I just felt it's the same thing. I just wavered back and forth between feeling like I was good at it and then terrible and audiences liking it and not. And I remember being in Swindon once and someone actually shouting, "Taxi for the Comedian," which I didn't realise was a real thing. I thought that was just something you heard about as a legend, but someone actually shouted it. Yeah, it was brutal.
Did you ever get some, apart from that one, was there any really bad heckles that you got that have kind of stuck in your mind and you're thinking, that was the worst?
Not really. It was always just sort of silence that was always the most corrosive. Just sort of the kind of creaking of chairs. And just, you know, there's something about that that's a lot more chilling. I mean, the funny thing is, once you've died on stage, it feels a bit like if your parachute hasn't opened and you're like, oh, well, may as well enjoy the view. And there's sort of, it's a bit like that, you know? It just, you sort of think, well, actually, I haven't died.
Yeah.
I've just, it's just been agonizing for a bit. And so you become quite hardened to it.
Also, if you do a joke and you say,
It's like in the background.
Yes. Oh,
a bit of an echo.
Brutal. Brutal. Yeah, I definitely had that a number of times. I by that point, I was doing, my act was sort of, it was sort of me pretending to be a sort of an arrogant comedian. So the joke was sort of, it was like a, almost like a character where I would come on and I'd say, yeah, well, they know me in, they know, funny enough, they know me in Swindon. I'm huge there. And so the joke was sort of, why were the audience not laughing? And then it became quite sort of, you know, it was almost like a satire on the nature of stand-up comedy. And if the audience went with it, killer, they loved it. But if they didn't get the joke, done for. I mean, I had nowhere to go because I had no act. That was the act. And that was when it was at its most agonizing.
Then what would you do? Just stand there, like, or just
keep going?
Think of jokes
no,
as you go.
Just kept going, just plowed on until the end because you didn't get paid unless you did your full 20
really?
Minutes. But it's funny because now I look back on it and I think actually I was more brave and sort of freer in a way then when I didn't have any kind of profile, no one knew who I was, than I am now. Now you're much more, because now if you do something like that and it doesn't work, people are on Twitter immediately, just all Steve Merchant terrible. You know, why has he got 18 houses like Elton John? whereas then, you know, no one knew who I was, so you just, you embarrassed yourself in front of 50 people and then you went home and it was fine.
Oh, you got the feeling that I want to feel. Oh, you got the feeling that I know is real, real, real. It's in the way you look, it's in the way. Turn.
Let's talk about The Office then, and like so many people, I loved it. So many things I wanted to ask about this. Mm. Now, how did you actually come up with the idea of The Office?
Well, in quite a roundabout way, I was working at a radio station with Ricky Gervais, and he had a kind of couple of sort of observations about sort of office life that he would kind of play out, and we would sort of improvise a bit just for our own amusement. And then I did this training scheme at the BBC, and while I was there, I had to do a sort of exercise one day as a director, learn to be a director. Mm-hmm. And so I said to Ricky, look, let's develop that and into a character and into a thing. And so we did that, and we just went back to an old office that he'd worked at, and we just sort of semi-improvised this thing with Ricky doing an amazing job as that character. Mm-hmm. And just suddenly, you know, finished editing it and realized that it was sort of gold dust, you know, and that just the character was really just vivid and funny, and Ricky's performance was sort of exceptional, and we thought, oh, this is something. And then it just sort of spiraled from there, and we, you know, it got sort of passed around the BBC and people saw it, and then they sort of gathered the momentum. But so it was never, although I wanted to be involved with comedy and my aspiration was to do a sitcom, it was quite a sort of coincidental, lots of good luck and kind of chance and being in the right place at the right time and meeting someone as talented as him. And so, yeah, it wasn't like we sat down and wrote a script and sent it off in an envelope and hoped that they would make it.
At any point you were writing that script, though, did you think this is going to be huge?
No.
Or wasn't it until afterwards and other people saw it and heard about it and you'd made it, did it get to that point, or was it even later on?
I think when we finished editing this series, I think we thought, oh, this is quite good. Like, this is nice. This is what we wanted it to be.
Yeah.
And that there will be a small, very small audience for whom this is their favorite thing, mm-hmm. because it seemed like we'd nailed what it was to work in an office at that time. You know, we felt we were right there. And we thought, oh, if we get like a million viewers, which would have been big, we'd be happy. And it kind of came out, and I think it was in the summer, and no one really paid attention. And I remember being on a train after the first episode had aired. And obviously no one knew who I was. And I was sat next to these two ladies on the train. And one of them said to the other, hey, did you see that documentary last night about life in office? Oh, the boss, he's a character. And the other woman said, oh, I don't think that was a documentary. I think that was a sitcom.
Yeah.
And the other woman went, oh, well, it wasn't very funny then. And she'd loved it within seconds ago. And then by the moment she thought it was a comedy, hated it. And I think there was a lot of people that did either thought it was a real documentary, thought it was a comedy, wasn't there, it's a cup of tea. And it just took a long time, I think, for people to get in the groove of it, you know? And so, I mean, it took at least a year or so before we started feeling like people were talking about it and that there was a kind of buzz about it.
Now, you were only in it for, like, an episode, pretty much, weren't you? With the Og Monster.
Yeah, very briefly, yeah.
Because Ricky Gervais obviously played David Brent. You know, he was the main character in every single episode.
Yeah.
Did you not want to be that side of the camera?
You know, it never really occurred to me. It was one of those things, like I say, the same way that it began, it all just started to happen, you know? And then we were writing it, and then it was getting made, and we never sat down to have a conversation about, like, who was good. You know what I mean? If there'd been a character that was right for me, then I probably would have played it, but there wasn't really. And so it never came up, and I never was annoyed about it. I was just too busy with everything else. I mean, we were writing it and directing it and editing it, and it, you know, there was more than enough to do, really. And so I never felt shortchanged or kind of annoyed or upset in that way. I was just pleased to be doing something that I liked doing that felt good.
Wasn't your dad in it?
My dad's in it a couple of times. The guy just comes in and stares at the camera.
Whose idea was that to put him in there?
We had used him in something else, and he just had a very funny kind of gormless look. And obviously we were aping documentaries, and so for a while we thought it would have been funny to have a character whose face was blurred out in every episode. You never saw his face because he hadn't given permission to the documentary people to be included. And then we thought that was just a little bit too knowing and a bit too much of a wink. Mm. But we did like the idea that my dad was the only person in the show who was just transfixed by the camera and couldn't take his eyes off it and was just intimidated by it. And so we would throw him in occasionally for that.
Does he...
Do you know, he sometimes get recognised. In fact, he has his own... Someone set up a Tumblr on the, and he occasionally will get recognised, like in a car park or in a cafe or something. He gets very excited.
Really?
He plays it cool.
Does he? Is he just like?
He said, "Oh yeah,
it's no big deal."
It's me.
It's no big deal. Well,
and he gets out his silver pen, his autograph pen that he carries with him. If I could turn the page,
Jason Webster meets Stephen Merchant.
BFBS. With the American office as well, you know, you went to America. Is the comedy quite different compared to what it's like in the UK? Did you have to change quite a few things around?
We weren't heavily involved with it because the smart thing I thought we did there was knowing that, like you say, that the humour is different there. And even though it seems like we understand it because we watch so much of it and we enjoy it, I think we thought, you know what, we're going to try and replicate our version, and that's a mistake. They need to just take the idea and run with it themselves. Mm-hmm. And so I think that was our smartest move, was handing it over to people there who were extremely talented and just did their own thing. And the more time I've spent there, the more I've realised that there is a big difference in American and British humour, and mainly it is to do with optimism. Mm. They just do believe that life can be good, you know? I mean, and I always think it's interesting, if you think about a show like, when I was growing up, one of my favourite shows was Whatever Happened to the Lightning Lads. I don't know if you remember that, but it was two guys, and they were sort of approaching middle age, and one was married, one wasn't, and the opening theme tune, the lyrics of the opening theme tune were along the lines of, oh, what happened to you? Whatever happened to me? What became of the people we used to be? Like, it was depressing and dark and gloomy. And that was the opening credits. And you think about something like Friends, I'll Be There for You. Yeah, it's like, and that to me sums up the difference. You know, like we in this country, Fools and Horses, Basil Fawlty, Dad's Army, they're about losers, some of whom are pretty quite malevolent losers. I mean, Basil Fawlty can at times be a tyrant, you know. And we seem to embrace that as British audience, you know, whereas I think American viewers do want their characters to just be a bit nicer and a bit more hopeful and a bit more optimistic.
Yeah, and it's the same within extras as well. There's Ricky Gervais in that character of Andy Millman.
Yeah.
He's one of these guys, he's trying to work his way up, and it's a lot harder. I think if that was an American show, he'd already be at the top.
And well, you know, when you think about it, it's a show like Entourage, right? Yeah. Where they're already superstars, you know. That seems like that's the kind of flip of extras.
Even with Darren Lamb, with your character and that, he's a bad agent.
He's the worst man for the job.
Yeah.
And I think, as I say, I do think British audiences kind of embrace that. I don't know whether we've sort of a healthy cynicism, a healthy sarcasm. I mean, I think we're much more... I think it works in two ways. Like, I think on the one hand, it's a sort of healthy British kind of don't get bigger than your station, and you know, and kind of the flip of that is that sometimes it can stifle ambition, you know, and that sometimes, you know, people in Britain can feel a little bit like they shouldn't shoot for the stars and they shouldn't kind of go, you know, dream big.
Yeah.
Just because there is a certain kind of, you see it in the British press, right? As soon as someone becomes successful, they try and chop them down immediately, you know. Whereas in America, there is a kind of, they celebrate success. They, you know, for any, you know, you can be an idiot, but if you're doing well, they just root for you. It's very odd. I always think that the difference between English and America ultimately is that in America, if you're a kid and you say, I want to be president, people go, yeah, go for it. Good for you. And in England, if you went, I want to be Prime Minister, people were like, yeah, all right, mate. Good luck with that.
Keep dreaming.
Yeah, keep dreaming.
BFBS, Original Forces Programme. Tall Stories. Jason Webster meets Stephen Merchant. BFBS.
Obviously, you know what makes a good sitcom. I actually have come up with an idea for a sitcom.
Okay.
Can I run it by you?
Sure. If I like it, I will take it. And there's no evidence that it was yours.
That's true.
Yeah.
And so you've got the contacts as well.
I've got all the contacts, mate.
First of all, the name is Brizzle because it's set in Bristol. What do you think of that already?
You thought you'd try and win me over by basing it in my hometown.
Well, actually, it's just because people from Bristol, because I live in Swindon, go to Bristol quite a lot, and I swear this happened, been out for the night out, went for a fry up the next day, and even police don't sound intimidating. It's something to do with the accent as well, I think.
Yeah. David Prowse, who was the bodybuilder who played the body of Darth Vader, is from Bristol.
Yeah.
And he did all the lines when they originally filmed it. I mean, he did the lines behind the mask. And so there is presumably a recording somewhere of him saying, Luke, I'm your father, the old babber. All right? Come over to the dark side. Come on. It's over here.
It's not as intimidating.
It's not, is it? And apparently he turned up at the premiere. He expected to hear his voice. James Earl Jones' voice came out. He was devastated.
I bet he was.
I know.
So, already you're into the Bristol thing.
Brizzle, I like it. Brizzle. I like the title.
Okay, Brizzle is set in Bristol. It's five main characters, the main storyline being based around one guy called Dan.
Okay.
Just a normal name.
I've met people called Dan, I can relate to
exactly,
that.
Exactly, yeah. My best mate's called Dan.
There you are.
So, that's kind of where I got the name. The story's focused around his struggle of having to move back into house with his mum.
Right.
Her new boyfriend, who he's never met. We'll find out why in a minute.
Okay.
And his mum's boyfriend's two older children.
Right.
So altogether, there's five people in the story. So Dan is 23.
All right.
He moved out of his family home when he was 18 to go travelling, then went straight on to study business studies at the University of East Anglia.
Uh-huh.
You've got to actually focus on the main bits here.
Right.
But East Anglia.
Yeah, there's a lot of detail.
Yeah, a lot of detail, yeah.
Yeah.
He did 2 years at East Anglia, but then dropped out because it was boring.
Right.
It wasn't for him. He then went to move back home with his mum, and he spent a lot of his days getting angry and frustrated at the real world.
Sure.
Because you would do.
Of course you would.
Everything for you. In the-
yeah. Sorry, and how many years did you do at East Anglia?
Two.
He did two and he dropped out.
Dropped
just
out.
To remember, I've got to remember, keep all this in the head because I'm assuming this is important.
Yeah, I can email this to you.
Please.
So Judith is Dan's mum.
Okay, Judith, right. Has anyone got a piece of paper so I can write this down? Because I'm...
It's all right, I said I'll
email it. Dan and Judith, right?
Dan, Judith,
Dan,
so
and Dan's 23 and he went to East Anglia.
Okay.
I'll tell you. 23, Dan.
Yeah.
Judith, mum.
She wanted to get back out there.
Sure.
She was a single mum.
Sure.
So she met a guy called Keith. Remember that?
How old's Keith?
Let's find out in a minute.
All right.
On a dating site about boat enthusiasts called findyourfirstmate.com.
Like it?
Good
joke
name.
There, yeah. That's the first joke. Yeah.
After a couple of months, she decided to move in with Keith and his adult children in Bristol.
Brizzle.
What do you think?
Well, there's no reason why it wouldn't be good. I mean, honestly, it makes sense. You know, you've got family dynamic. That's a classic setup, right? You've got different generations. You've got conflict, potentially, because you've got old, you know, sons, new blood, new brothers and sisters, as it were. I can see all of those things. But in the end, it's only as good as what you end up writing.
Yeah, I mean, that's the terrible
truth of it. You know, you can come up with a premise, and it's funny. I mean, I get stopped all the time. You know, I've got an idea. You should write about the office I live in or I work in. But until you've actually written it on a piece of paper... I'm saying I'm not shooting it down because it could work as an idea, but at the moment it's only that's all it is, you know.
It's an idea,
and it's funny because, you know, it's quite hard to sort of sell on a one or two lines. So in the end, it comes down to the script and is it funny and do people laugh.
I'll send you the Word document.
Don't do that. But I'll tell you what, write it and then don't send me that either. But but no, what I mean is, I'm saying until you have a script, I don't think you've got anything yet to put on the telly. But I don't think there's anything wrong with the idea.
So the idea does work.
The idea's got all the elements. Yeah.
Okay,
it's
thanks.
Got all the elements.
Thank you.
Are you going to write it?
Humour me. I would. I don't think I'm very good at writing stuff.
That's your problem then. Yeah.
But don't know until you've written it, like I said.
There you are.
I remember us alone, waiting for the light to go. Don't you feel that hunger? I've got so many secrets to show. When I saw you on that stage, I shivered with the look you gave. Don't you hear that rhythm? Can you show me how we can escape? I was biting my tongue, I was trying to hide. I forget what I've done, I'll be redefined. Part of me you change, just hold me together, tell me you'll always want me to stay. I was biting my tongue, I was trying to hide. I'll forget what I've done, I'll be redeemed. I'm gonna
I was watching your stand-up actually earlier this week. It's really animated. Yeah, and you do this thing about dancing as well. There's a quote with Cole Pilkington, and he says that your dancing is a bit of a weird art.
Sure.
I thought it was quite good.
I think I'm quite good dancer.
I think you could teach me how to dance. What do you think?
Quite possibly.
Teach me the... So, can we go through some of the basics?
Well, I don't know if I can, really. I just think you... I mean, to be honest with you, I think you've either got it or you haven't.
Okay.
And my sense is, from looking at you, that you haven't.
Why?
Just, I can tell. I can just tell that... Because you know what it is? You're too... Yeah. You are very British.
Yeah.
And I've spent some time in America. Now I'm a lot more in touch with my body.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a lot freer, looser, Californian, kind of hippie. Whereas you, still a bit buttoned up. I got two buttons undone. You've only got one. And have no inhibitions. I actually have to say, if I dance in public, the reason I'm self-conscious about doing it now is I'm not as... I do need to have had a couple of drinks. Because I was once in a nightclub and I was dancing and I glanced in the mirror and I was about 2 foot taller than everyone else in there. And it did look weird. It looked like I was a teacher dancing at a school disco with a bunch of kids. It just was a bit creepy. So I am much more self-conscious about dancing in public now.
Tall Stories. Jason Webster meets Stephen Merchant. BFBS.
The Hello Ladies TV series.
Right.
A lot of it was based on the stand-up. For people that have never seen it, have never watched it, tell us a little bit about a little bit of the brief.
Well, it was born, as you say, partly from the stand-up show, which was about the sort of, you know, all the kind of my various dating experiences over the years, and then also born from the fact that I'd been spending time in LA, and there is a very specific vibe to that city that it can be very lonely because, you know, unlike almost any other city, you know, you drive everywhere, and so you don't really bump into people as such. You know, everyone's very isolated. You know, if you live in the hills, you can't just pop across the road to the shops. You've got to drive to the shop. So it can be quite an isolating place. And I just thought, I just like the idea of this kind of loser from England who's gone to LA in order to sort of reinvent himself and pursue the dream of, you know, sort of VIP parties and beautiful women and kind of faced with the reality, which is that stuff is there, but it doesn't mean that it's accessible to you. You know, it's still behind a kind of red velvet rope. There's still a man with a clipboard saying, if your name's not down, you're not coming in.
Mm. There was a scene where you are leaning on the fridge. I think the girl's name's Annie that's working behind in the gym. And lean on this fridge, then you can stand up and lean back in and you fall into the...
Into that was my little homage to the Del Boy.
Is that kind of like a tribute to British comedy?
Oh, definitely, very much. So there's all that all the way through it, because what I realised was there was loads of stuff that I loved that didn't really have any reflection or echo in America, like Eric Morecambe's kind of manner or the way he adjusts his glasses, all those sort of things that I often do as like little inside nods to anyone who recognises it as being a British thing.
And also the movie as well. How did that move on from the TV show and then comes to doing the movie? How'd that work?
HBO were like, you know, we want you to do this kind of film to wrap up the show. And I was like, yeah, great. And that was nice because it gave me a chance to basically do my sort of version of a romantic comedy, which you don't really see as much anymore. Like, they used to be a big thing, right? Harry Met Sally and all that stuff. Got to do a scene on a yacht, which was
classic.
Which was nice. Yeah. And we had all these beautiful girls in kind of bikinis and heels, you know, and kind of trying to make it look as sort of sexy and cool as possible. I had to take it out of the harbour into the main ocean because we had a helicopter that was going to do helicopter shots to really sell the glamour of it. And as soon as we got out of the harbour, the ocean was so rough. It was up and down. It was like something from that film, A Perfect Storm. It was mental. And of course, I had this helicopter for about 20 minutes and I needed to get these shots. I was directing. And I had these poor women. I was throwing them out on the front of the ship. Water was crashing over. They're like, we're going to topple over. I was like, you're in a bikini. Swim. They suddenly, because these women weren't women anymore. They were just like props that I needed for this shoot. And honestly, I thought it was going to be a mutiny. I thought it was going to be like that film, what was it called? Captain Roberts or whatever, you know, with Tom Hanks.
Yeah. Captain Phillips.
Captain Phillips. I thought it was going to be like that. But instead of like that Somalian guy going, I'm the captain now. It was going to be like a girl called, you know, sort of Brooke.
Yeah.
It was like, I'm like totally the captain now and just take over the ship and kind of just mute. Because it was crazy out there. It was, and that's the terrible thing when you're directing as well as acting. You just turn potentially into a monster because you've suddenly got the panic of they're burning money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got to get the shots, otherwise it won't make sense. You've got all this responsibility. It's terrible. People just turn into kind of cattle.
Just pop up, I'm doing gone.
Jason Webster meets Stephen Merchant.
BFBS. So we were talking about Hello Ladies, and you must have got a lot of advice whilst you were doing that on how to get with the ladies. Mm. And what I've got here is a list of chat-up lines, which I think, because some people, they still struggle with the ladies.
Yeah.
Apparently, some of these work 100% of the time.
Really?
And some of them have never worked. If you could tell me which ones you think are the good ones and which ones are the terrible ones.
Okay.
Okay? Is your father a thief? Because he must have stolen your eyes from heaven. Is that...
That's terrible.
Never works?
I think that never works.
You're right, that never works. Yes, well done. I'm in a cuddle gang. Do you want to join? Works 100% of the time.
I think that works, although I also think that sounds creepy, doesn't it? A cuddle gang.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's because you imagine they've got like a sort of tatty old white van.
Yeah.
And they're just cuddling, but even so, it's a bit grotty. I think it does work, though, because it's quite funny.
Apparently that one works 100%
of the time. 100%
of the time? According to Tinder. Are you my appendix? Because this feeling in my stomach makes me want to take you out. What do you think that works 100% of the time?
I think that never works. It's too complicated. It's got sort of medical elements to it. It's a bit weird.
You my appendix, it, like in the loud
it's a
club.
Little, and it's also, it's a little bit sort of, it's a bit kind of Hannibal Lecter-y. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Taking body organs out. It's
No, apparently that works.
No, it doesn't.
Apparently...
All right, well, if people are listening here and they need chat-up lines, then do not use that one.
Yeah, I think that's...
Join a cuddle gang. The more I think about that, the creepier it sounds. My main chat-up line is, would you like to meet Carl Pilkington? That works.
So what?
That always works.
Is it?
Who doesn't want to meet Carl?
Working with people like Ricky and Carl, how is that? Is it like working with anybody else you've ever worked with in the past?
Oh, no. I mean, you know, Ricky is unique and just brilliant. And Carl is unique and brilliant in a very different way, in the way, you know, a kind of genius moron would be. I mean, I've never met anyone like him. He is remarkable. And he just sees the world through a different set of eyes than everyone else. And that's the stuff that you would spend ages trying to write, you know, as a comedy writer, trying to create that stuff. Yeah. And it just comes out of his brain fully formed. You know, it's sort of extraordinary.
But a lot of the stuff that he says, you think, actually, that kind of makes sense.
You might.
My wife is always, she's like, yeah, I totally agree. I think she agrees with everything he says, to be honest.
Really?
Yeah. She's like, yeah, I totally agree with that.
Does she agree that you never see an old man eating a Twix? Does she agree with that particular...
Probably. Yeah, I mean, she's got a weird way of thinking as well, I think. Like, move to Swindon when there's mice living in the house.
Yeah.
That was her idea.
That was her idea. To be fair, she probably didn't know about the mice when you bought the place.
No, she does now. I was hiding on the sofa.
She had to get rid of it?
Yeah, she did, yeah. She had to coax it out of the Coca-Cola box.
Is she your wife or your carer?
BFBS. Original Forces Programme. Tall Stories. Jason Webster meets Stephen Merchant. BFBS.
Well, at the moment, everyone wants a piece of you. You know, you're on all these different TV shows. How does it feel to be in such demand?
Well, that's flattering of you to say. I'm not sure that I feel quite the same way, but I'm working on some scripts at the moment, which are film scripts, and that is mainly me sat in that office we mentioned earlier, just working away. I mean, literally get up, make a cup of coffee, answer some emails, and then you sit there working on a script until you can't do any more. And it's the same every day until 120 pages are written that work and that are interesting and that make sense. And it literally is like assembling an Airfix model. You know, if you came into a room and someone was assembling a Spitfire and they were just sticking the wing on, and then you came back later and they were just adding the tail, you'd be like, ugh. But to them, it's absolutely hypnotic and fascinating, and there's something very satisfying about seeing the finished product. So all these other things that you mentioned, the Big Bang Theory or whatever, they're just fun distractions for a few days. But the truth is, I'm sat there on the set thinking, I've got to get back to the Airfix.
Then lip-sync battle as well. Is that a fun little part?
There's a good example of how you never know what audiences want.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, who'd have thought? For those that haven't seen it, it's a show in which people lip-sync to songs, then That's it. That's the premise.
Yeah.
People love it. Phenomenon.
And it's such a simple idea.
Crazy.
It's so popular.
Crazy. I was in a car driving home from a place in Northern California with my friends John Krasinski, who's married to the actress Emily Blunt. Mm-hmm. Good friends of mine. We were sat
also
in the car.
From American Office as well.
He's from the American Office. And he and I were lip syncing two songs for fun on the iPod, just sort of joking around. And he was planning to be on a talk show in the States. And I said, oh, why don't you do this on the show? That would be funny. It's just something about it that seemed funny. He was the one who came up with it as a contest, two people battle. It was huge on the Jimmy Fallon talk show, huge online. I mean, I did my version, my first one I did, with Single Ladies by Beyonce. Within the course of a weekend, it was sort of 30 million views. I mean, you can't get that for a TV show that you've worked on for a year. You'd be lucky if you got that kind of audience for a blockbuster film. I mean, it's crazy how quickly that stuff spreads. And so now they've made it into a TV show, you know, and it's wild. And you'd never, there's no way when you're sat in that car driving down the road that you would think that was anything other than a mildly amusing diversion on a talk show.
You know, you're in LA, you've got all these awards, like numerous awards, you know, TV shows and movies. Could you ever imagine that ever happening?
I couldn't. You're right, no. But I did always think, worth a shot, you know, worth a shot. Partly because one of my heroes, we've mentioned him before, John Cleese, he went to school in Bristol, he grew up in Weston-super-Mare. He was very tall like me. And I just, for some reason, I remember thinking, oh, he did it. Which was weird. I mean, because I was not confident terribly about other things. I just, for some reason, I just thought, give it a punt, you know, and see if it works out. So, although I could never have imagined quite the things I've experienced, I remember thinking, worth having a go, you know? And that, honestly, would be my only advice when people ask me, like, what's the advice you can give? It's like, have a go.
For the future, then, what's your next project? I know you've got a couple in the pipeline.
These film scripts, which I'm developing, which I'm trying to finish at the moment, which are, I think, fun and interesting and kind of exciting. Until they actually are done and dusted and I've sort of written the end. I won't tell you what they are, just because they might not happen and then I'll just be embarrassed.
That's what I was a bit worried about, Brizzle.
I think Brizzle's got legs. I just think it needs jokes.
I mean, you could do... obviously, James Corden going over to do the late night TV show. You know, would you ever do something like that?
As I said before, my thing is I like sitting in that little room, trying to finish the Airfix model. That takes my fancy.
Or a game show host. You could do that. Wear a shiny jacket. Uh-huh. Didn't you do Blockbuster?
I did Blockbusters back in the day.
Yeah,
I was a contestant on that. I did. Embarrassing.
Very well.
It was a sham. First question. Which E is the brother of Charlie Sheen? Emilio Estevez. I thought, I'm off and running here. I don't think I answered another question. It was embarrassing. I won £15.
That's right.
Pathetic. No, it wasn't. They sent me the check, and I remember that there was a corner of the check that was missing. It was as though they'd written it. Bob Holness had written it and gone, £15. That guy was pathetic and had just torn the check out of the checkbook with contempt, leaving half of it behind. And the whole thing was deeply embarrassing.
Steve Merchant, thank you so much for talking to me today. Good luck with everything you've got in the future. Not that you need it, because you're on fire at the moment with everything you're doing.
Thank you very much indeed. Nice to talk to you, and thank you, and good luck with Brizzle.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
BFBS, original Forces programs. On digital radio, FM, and satellite TV in the UK.
Online and on air, around the world.
This is the Forces Station.
BFBS.